Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us a little later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, it seems as though a new government of national unity row could be looming over South Africa's next ambassador to the United States. Predatory lending and debt abuse is a human rights issue, claims one expert. How citizens are now paying the price for the much-contested budget. And is business doing enough to combat TB in the workplace? It's Tuesday, the 25th of March. I want to lead our program today with the art of ambassadorship, and let me give you some background. The two biggest parties in the Government of National Unity have added another matter to the long list of issues they reportedly disagree on. A debate on who should replace expelled South African ambassador to the United States, Ibrahim Rasool, may just be another bone of contention for the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. And I want to get a view now from former DA leader and one-time ambassador to Argentina, Tony Leon. Tony, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's start with this. What do you think the real reason was behind the expulsion? And do you think it was an overly extreme measure from Washington?
Hi, Jeremy. Good afternoon. Nice to chat. Well, firstly, it was it's about the most extreme thing you can do, short of a declaration of war, to expel a country's ambassador. So it pretty much was on the far end of the menu of diplomatic options. So I think that's the first answer. The real reason, well, the ostensible reason could be part of the real reason. In other words, what Ibrahim Rasool did, heroes welcome on his return notwithstanding, was completely undiplomatic. It was way outside the rule book of how diplomats behave in a foreign country to their host president and host nation. And the only excuse could be, which is actually rather troubling, is that he did it with the express authorization of the presidency or the Department of International Relations, in other words, his comments. If that isn't the explanation, he should be carpeted, not welcomed back as a hero. Look, I think there are a number of issues that have been well ventilated about the Trump White House's displeasure with South Africa, Jeremy, and with our international alignment and the policy prescriptions here at home. And, you know, I think that Rasool just gave them the excuse to send a signal about those things on which his own behavior was only a part or symptom but not cause.
You've written, Tony Leon, that this is a seismic diplomatic event. I'd like to know how damaging this expulsion is for South Africa's reputation on the global diplomatic stage. It can't be good.
It isn't good. Look, I've been certainly, you know, people talk about this the most serious breach in 31 years. It's actually fundamentally the most serious breach I can recall, because if you go back to the isolationist days of apartheid, South Africa's ambassadors were often cold-shouldered and carpeted in foreign governments and places they were stationed. But I can't recall, with one exception in South America, ironically, where a South African ambassador was expelled or declared a persona non grata. So it's a very serious breach. It's a very poor signal. Look, a lot of countries are grappling with the phenomenon of Trump and Trump world, and we are one of several. But I think, you know, assuming, and I think it's a fair assumption, that Trump is a bully or he uses unconscionable methods to get his ends, that is a signal he's sending of when you cross him, these are the results. And I think it will make other countries wary about engaging with us. Some, of course, will see it as a means to express solidarity. Others, I think, will be more cautious.
What, in your opinion, then, makes an effective ambassador in this age of protocol-busting populism?
Well, look, you know, Jeremy, I, as I said when I was ambassador to my embassy colleagues in Buenos Aires, we've got to be a profit center, not a cost center. I mean, our embassies are extremely expensive. I mean, I left the diplomatic service in 2012, and then a medium-sized embassy such as the one we had in Argentina cost the South African taxpayer over $5 million per annum to maintain. And you can just, you know, multiply that by whatever figure for today and to many other embassies. You've got to be a salesman, or you've got to be a sales force for your country. And the metrics on which any embassy should be judged, in my opinion, is what have they done to the trade balance? Has it improved on their watch? What have they done to the public profile of the country? Not the publicity Rasul got, but more positive publicity. And what have they done to deepen, enhance, and strengthen bilateral or even multilateral ties? Those, I think, are the three measurements of effective diplomatic work. And a lot of the work is done not by ambassadors, but by heads of states. It's done on Twitter or X, as you've seen recently. So I think the ambassador has a role to play. But, you know, a point that I wrote about last week, if I could just rephrase it here, is actually, you know, you could have a homegrown Henry Kissinger sent from Pretoria to Washington now to repair the breach. But frankly, even a diplomatic phenomenon like that would be hard-pressed to change the terms of engagement absent the policies that have led to our estrangement with the White House starting to change, or at least be moderated. And I don't see at the moment too much sign of change or moderation on our part.
Let me ask you this question, Tony Leon. If you were offered the job, would you take it?
Well, Helen Ziller nominated me very
generously. That's why I'm asking you the question.
But I haven't been offered that by anyone from the official world. And the answer is I simply don't know, because it's a hypothetical speculation. But I, as you say, in the world of retail, everything, an offer like that, however, you know, flattering it might be, has got to be subject to, as they say in retail, T's and C's, terms and conditions. So as to go back to what I said a moment ago to your previous question, absent a step change of policy by Pretoria, I don't think that you can be an effective ambassador, at least in the United States.
We love a hypothetical question, Tony Leon, on this program. So let's assume that you were given the job. What would the first order of business be? How does South Africa go about repairing that relationship with Washington? Or for the next 4 years, is it irretrievably broken?
Well, the first thing, if I were there, and this is entirely hypothetical and speculative, is before I left these shores, I would have a serious sit-down with the Director General, Durko, and with the Minister of International Relations, and would say to them, well, listen, I can just tell you from what's in the ether or on the internet, these are the fundamental problems with the relationship. It's not about being rude or polite. These are the issues, one, two, three. What are the prospects of moderating these issues, toning them down, and or indeed changing course in certain cases? And if they say there's no change of tone, there's no change of course, there's no adjustment, there's no moderation, then I think I would be hard-pressed to leave. If there was some indication that there could be a change, or there could be a change of emphasis or a rearrangement of priorities, then I think it is a doable situation. And once you're there, you know, diplomacy, like, you know, peace negotiations are not done with your friends, but they're done with your adversaries. And I think for far too long, the South African diplomatic presence in Washington, D.C., as conveyed to me by people there, has been spent, you know, in the comfort of the comrades. So they've spent an inordinate amount of effort and time with, for example, the Black Congressional Caucus. That might have had some purchase during the Biden presidency. It's got no influence at all under the Trump presidency. So I would rearrange my diplomatic calendar and my diary to reflect current realities as they are, not sort of struggle days as they once were. The second thing I think you've got to do is you've got to go out there and you've got to put, not in a dishonest way, because that's self-defeating, your best foot forward. You've got to say, well, actually, these are South Africa's attributes. And I mean, just one example, I don't know whether it's been done or not. The United States imports from South Africa 100% of its chrome requirements. Now, why we are the sole provider of chrome for the US, I'm not sure. But what I do know is I would start emphasizing those aspects and saying, well, you know, this is what we're providing, this is what we're exporting, although we do have a trade surplus with you, I think it is beneficial, and let's build on that. There was some talk, for example, Jeremy, of trying to get a free trade agreement. Well, that obviously needs to be ramped up, because I think it's pretty much close to a racing certainty that AGOA is going to be phased out, or we will disappear from it, in which case you need something to substitute, and you need to start saying, well, how are we going to engage with America? I'll tell you the other easy one I would go for, since you ask. I would absolutely go for bringing Starlink to South Africa. Let's assume, I think he is, that Errol Musk is one of the chief Trump whisperers, maybe not such a whisperer, but the loud voice in the White House. And he has made a particular thing about Starlink not being available in South Africa because of various equity disposals he's obliged to do. I would go out of my way if I were the South African government and say, okay, I'm going to have a special case here. You know, we do it all the time. You know, the container port requirement or tender in Durban, which is now subject to a court case, did not actually have a BEE component in that particular specification. I mean, we can have a big argument about merits and demerits of BEE, what it does, what it doesn't do, how distorting it is. But on the simple fact that we don't always apply it, I would absolutely use Starlink and get easy access, quite aside from the benefits it will bring to rural schools and providing cheap internet access. It will be a visible win at very low cost and much benefit to this country, and might just warm up the relationship.
Tony Leon, thank you very much indeed, and please let us know if you're packing your bags.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, for millions of South Africans, debt has become a silent crisis that strips away dignity and choice. And there are some worrying numbers here. Over 40% of credit-active consumers are in one form of distress or another, and over 28 million people on social grants. The reality of predatory lending has become a lot more than a financial issue. I wonder if it's a human rights concern. We've just acknowledged Human Rights Day. And joining us to discuss this a little further is Dion Sherman from the National Debt Advisors Organization. And I want to talk about why reckless lending, dishonest credit practice, and financial exploitation should be treated as serious rights violations, and maybe, a lot more importantly, what can be done about it. Dion, a very warm welcome to you. And let me ask you bluntly then, the National Credit Act, do you think it's failing South Africans, or is the problem just about enforcement?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So that's actually a very, very good question. So the National Credit Act was put in place to protect consumers, to regulate the credit industry, and to put certain measures in place that hold credit providers and relevant stakeholders accountable. So the NCA is pretty much clear in what's considered as reckless lending, as well as what the potential consequences of reckless lending is. A lot of the credit providers are adhering to those provisions. However, what we found, and this is through reckless lending investigations that are done by debt counselors, is that a lot of the times consumers have provided information that may not be 100% accurate. So they might have overinflated their income or deflated their expenses. And so when these investigations are done, the credit providers provide credit agreements indicating that the consumers claim that they could afford debt to some extent. And so it kind of makes the reckless credit argument null and void, because the credit providers show that they've done their required due diligence. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that credit providers are not in the wrong. Marketing practices that market credit and market credit agreements and target specific groups of people that may, by just association, not be able to afford credit agreements, like, for example, grant recipients, that's where the real issue is at hand, is when we're targeting people who accept and are on social grants, when we target them to solicit or provide credit agreements to them, knowing that they're not going to be able to afford it, knowing that they're overinflating their expenses, and there aren't any real provisions that prevent those sorts of situations from taking place.
So what type of provisions are we talking about it and this and it does beg the question, surely, how lenders still get away with granting high interest loans to particularly social grant recipients who simply cannot afford it?
So the provisions within the National Credit Act outline that a credit agreement needs to meet certain standards. So, for example, it has to be the credit agreement itself has to be in a language that the consumer understands. The terms must have been explained to the consumer in full detail, and an affordability assessment should have been conducted prior to granting the credit agreement, which would facilitate or at least indicate to credit providers whether or not the consumer can afford the credit agreement. So what makes a loan reckless, basically, is where you grant credit to a consumer and the granting in that credit to the consumer leads that consumer to become over indebted, meaning that they don't have sufficient income to pay back that debt at the end of the month. So that is what makes it reckless per se, is within that process not doing your affordability assessment and the outcome of that affordability assessment indicating that the consumer doesn't or can't afford the debt, but then granting it to the consumer anyway. That's what makes it reckless because it places the consumer in a worse off position.
But the consumer surely has got to take some responsibility here. Often we see consumers misrepresent their financial situation to get credit. So there's got to be a balance surely between consumer accountability on the one hand and systemic exploitation as we've been discussing on the other.
And that's exactly where a majority of our reckless lending investigations lead to. It leads to that exact outcome where consumers have overinflated their income, where they've deflated their expenses. And it's usually the deflation of expenses because how do you prove expenses, right? You can get a bank statement, but then you could say, oh, no, but I withdraw my money and then I spend via cash.
Right.
So it's the expenses that's the crux of the matter, and that is usually how consumers get away with applying for debt that they can't really afford.
So is there a role then for banks and more formal lenders to play in offering safe credit alternatives, or potentially, Dion, are they part of the problem as well?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. You have micro lenders who tend to be a bit more, how would I say, adventurous with the law. The larger banks tend to, because they're so heavily regulated, they tend to have processes in place that mitigate those risks as much as possible. But yes, all role players have their part to play within the current problem that we have in South Africa. And it speaks to many other issues that we have as a society. Why do certain groups of people require or are in need of debt when they're already getting financial assistance? Is the financial assistance relevant to their situation? Is it a long-term solution? This problem is a symptom of a larger concern. And once we start addressing the larger concern, this won't be a problem anymore.
Just finally then, you call all of this, in other words, predatory lending, a human rights issue. So it's important that we elevate that back to that level, I guess, in the eyes of lawmakers and the public. But that's not really the case, is it?
Not necessarily. So, you see, reckless lending came about from the 2008 recession, where evidently enough, the cause of the recession within the US was reckless lending, where banks were giving out loans and mortgages to people who couldn't afford to pay them back. And that just led to a huge collapse in the market, and that had ripple effects across the world. So the NCA in its current form, along with reckless lending and the provisions to govern reckless lending, come about from the 2008 recession. With that being said, to some extent, yes, there's definitely certain aspects that the government and society can look at in order to address reckless lending and to address the fact that we may have people that are in compromised positions being directly targeted to facilitate loans and to provide loans to these people who can't afford it. Giving them those loans will place them in a worse off position, and then it leads them to being in a debt spiral when they can't even put food on the table. So it's definitely something to consider.
Dion Sherman, thank you very much indeed from National Debt Advisors. I do appreciate your time and for throwing some light on this very important issue.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, pragmatic or a missed opportunity, that is the debate that is still swirling, I think, around South Africa's 2025 budget, with a higher VAT rate on the horizon, just modest economic growth and pressure on both public and private sector workers. It really has become a tightrope walk between fiscal discipline and economic revival. And I want to flesh this out in a little more detail. Joining me now is Dr. Chris Blair, Chief Financial Officer of Remuneration Consultants 21st Century. And I want to break down what the budget really means for everyday South Africans now that we've had some time to digest it, and whether it does enough to ignite real change. So, Chris, a very warm welcome to you, and let's dive in with your overall assessment. The budget that we heard a week or so ago, was it bold enough, do you think, to address South Africa's economic stagnation, or some have said just a simple holding pattern?
Yes, Jeremy, and hello to all your listeners. I'm of the opinion, Jeremy, that it's just in a holding pattern. It's not really, it's a trade-off almost between austerity and prosperity. So obviously there are components to it that we'll get into, but all the actions that are taken in this budget are fairly short term, we should say, and not looking at that long term growth that South Africa needs to get to. So I think, yes, there's a need to obviously stem the interest payments on the debt, and that's pretty good in terms of bringing that down. But at the same time, the negative impact of the choices that have been made, particularly on perhaps on the VAT side, is just kicking the can down the road, really.
So let me pick you up on the kicking the can down the road. If, as you suggest, we are in a holding pattern, what do you think is the big risk then?
I think the big risk, Jeremy, is that the GDP growth is forecast at 1.9% for the next year. Our population growth is 1.5%. So we're really just treading water, if you can call it that. And until, and as you know, we've got that big unemployment problem. So until we actually increase GDP growth rather than try to contain the supply demand, which is kind of accolades to the people managing the budget that they're not spending more, but it's not adding value to the economy that the general man in the street, both public sector and private sector, could benefit from if there was that real growth. Real growth, we're probably looking at between 3 and 5% to make a difference.
So you mentioned then the need to shift from austerity to growth. Is there anywhere in this budget where there is some kind of growth stimulus?
So a little bit of growth stimulus in the infrastructure spending, and but, you know, does that really translate to the man in the street? Because probably that's aligned in the construction industry, not the total population. What really needs to move to things like accelerating private sector growth through tax incentives, which obviously works against that supply demand where they're trying to contain interest payments. But if the growth happens there, then they'll receive more taxes through various sources through that, even though they've given those incentives to kickstart it. The other area is obviously investing in skills, not just infrastructure. So there was no real comment about that. Maybe something like pairing with a 10 billion vocational training fund, or using the CETA funds more effectively so that people actually can improve their lives, get better jobs. And then lastly, obviously, reforming public sector efficiency. Obviously, they're looking to do that in terms of SARS collection, budgeting a further amount of money to SARS to make that more effective. But that's also not necessarily, it may get more money in, but it doesn't bolster the economy. And we really need to be making public sector more efficient so that it costs the country less.
Surely we've got to take, Chris, some solace from this infrastructure spend, though. It's a trillion rand. It's an eye-wateringly big number. Are you suggesting that we're not necessarily building for the right jobs and maybe even spending here without a solid compass or a clear direction?
Yeah, I think that's the nub of it, Jeremy, that if that money, even though it's a huge number, a trillion, but if it's not being used efficiently and effectively, then it's really just money down the drain. So the application of that infrastructure spending and the, let's call it the expansion of it to do the upskilling, would go a long way in terms of increasing GDP growth in the long term.
You referenced at the beginning of this conversation the rise in value-added tax. There's no doubt it's going to raise revenue and will raise it quickly if it comes to fruition. In other words, if it passes muster in the House. But it's also going to hit the poorest hardest. Do you think this was the best available option, or do you think it will remain a lazy choice?
Yeah, I think it's a easy choice rather than a lazy choice, because it's immediate. It comes in from the day that it's enacted, which is 1st of May for the first 0.5%. And then if you look at the actual numbers, the increased revenue coming from that VAT is about 42 million. But the actual savings on the items that are non-VATable is only 2 billion. So that's why it's an easy fix, because effectively, if you just take 1 year, it's 21 minus 2 is 19 billion in the positive for collection, but with only a 2 billion easing up for the people that are in that bracket that are eating and buying that sort of food. But as you know, you can't stick just only to your 19 VAT-exempt items. You actually, or zero-rated items, you've got other expenses, even as a poor person, that you can't avoid. So increasing the VAT will still affect them negatively.
Dr. Chris Blair, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Financial Officer of Remuneration Consultants 21st Century. Appreciate the analysis.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this past week saw World TB Day being acknowledged, and it's a reminder that tuberculosis remains one of the world's deadliest infectious diseases. The World Health Organization says global efforts have saved over 79 million lives in the past two decades, with 3.6 million deaths averted last year alone. But TB still affects millions of people, particularly in Southeast Asia and on the continent of Africa. And for businesses operating in high prevalence regions like South Africa, Nigeria and Kenya, the health and safety implications for staff are both real and ongoing. So I want to explore this in a little more detail with Dr. Chris von Straten, Global Health Advisor at International SOS. We're going to talk about the risks, the progress, and how businesses can play a greater role in tackling TB. Chris, thank you very much indeed. So maybe first of all, having listened to those numbers, one gets the sense that we are making some real progress here, or are we still falling short in TB prevention and control, perhaps globally and then on the continent?
Thanks so much for having me back on the show, Jeremy. So yeah, prior to 2019, those of us in global health and in public health were pretty optimistic that the numbers were stable, plateauing and dropping globally and in many of the developing countries. Then with the COVID-19 pandemic, funds being diverted, focus being diverted. Unfortunately, in some countries, not all, but in many, we've seen an uptick in TB cases and numbers. And we have seen an interesting uptick, for example, in the United Kingdom. They estimate an 11% increase. So it's a mixed bag from a scientific perspective, from a medical perspective, from a public health perspective. We have the tools. TB can be significantly diminished or eliminated, but it really does take real political will and putting the funding in the right places.
And as far as South Africa is concerned, given that there are so many competing health agendas, do you believe that political will exists?
Jeremy, again, that's a complex and a good question. Yes and no, but the yes is, as International SOS, we've been working with many of the big private companies in South Africa and on the continent and in parts of Asia. And with the big mining firms, they've taken TB very seriously. I'm not going to mention names, but there are mining companies in South Africa and in the countries you mentioned prior, where the TB rates on those sites is significantly lower than those reported by the MOH in those countries. And that was done by clever partnership, measuring what the numbers are, educating and destigmatizing TB, and then really driving efforts for screening, testing, and when detected, making sure it's a DOTS approach of observed treatment, follow-up care, appropriate accommodation, and protecting the travelers in between has had a massive impact. So I think, again, we've got to put focus on the private enterprise combined with public, civil, and NGOs to get us back on track.
How difficult is it for employers to create a TB-aware workplace without causing panic or stigma, as you've referred to?
It's a significant challenge, but it can be done. And it has been done effectively in many parts of the world. The developed world, I think, has become comfortable and in some instances complacent. In the developing world, it's a very real challenge. And yes, there is still stigma, and there's still that link between if someone got TB, well, then they must have HIV. And the fact is, things have changed significantly. HIV is no longer a death sentence. If you're on treatment and your viral load is low, your chances of picking up TB are heavily or significantly reduced. Your lifespan is extended, and with treatment, you can recover. So it is a challenge, but we have the tools that already exist. And if applied correctly and with that political will, it can be done.
In terms of those tools, you've referred to early detection as being critical. How can businesses better facilitate that process?
Yeah, excellent question. Some of the activities that we've certainly been engaged with International SOS and our partners and clients was to install a clinic on these sites, staff them with the appropriate nurses and doctors. And what is exciting too, I'm a tech geek, so watching the tools develop over the last 20 years, 20 years back, med school, we didn't have much, and it was laborious and time-consuming and very expensive. Now there are fantastic machines, PCR machines, that can be embedded on those sites, have a very rapid turnaround time, which means you can pick it up early, you can do mass screening, and you can get to treatment quickly and effectively. So things have changed, and I predict that they'll continue to improve.
How important is it for companies to either rewrite or review their occupational health policies in order to play a more significant role in reducing TB risk at work?
Great question, and I think it's very important. There are multiple teams globally that do this, companies like International SOS, but others too. I think it's a no-brainer. If you, and I hope we can discuss this on future calls, the return on investment is obviously critically important for any company. And in South Africa, we know that we need economic growth. That's the only way you create jobs. That's the only way we're going to drive our economy forward. The economic and social impact of TB is huge, A, for the individual, but B, for the companies. And the companies, the multi-billion dollar companies globally that are in production, that are in mining, have understood this and have been doing this for some time. So, and what they did, part of that was looking at the occupational health, the whole umbrella package, and then focusing on specific diseases like TB, because they could clearly see the return on investment versus the money spent.
And just finally, if you could wrangle one commitment from business leaders in South Africa as we talk about tuberculosis, what would it be?
We can end tuberculosis, and we do need to ensure that private and government and the NGOs are communicating effectively. I think that's probably the key message. Thank you.
And thank you indeed, Dr. Chris van Straten, Global Health Advisor at International SOS. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're back tomorrow live at noon, then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.